Hello, and welcome to the Deep Dive. I'm Alex Johnson.
And I'm Sam Kennedy.
Our mission here on the Deep Dive is pretty straightforward. You send us a stack of sources, articles, research, maybe your own notes, and we dive right in.
Yeah, we sift through it all, trying to pull out the most important nuggets of knowledge, those key insights.
It's our way of helping you get truly well-informed, kind of a shortcut, maybe with a few surprising facts thrown in, hopefully enough to keep you hooked.
Definitely.
So today we are taking a deep dive into the federal news update for Saturday, August 16th, 2025. We're focusing back on Friday, August 15th, 2025. And what a day it was. Really pivotal for the U.S. federal government.
It really was marked by just incredibly decisive, almost rapid-fire actions across all three branches: executive, legislative, and judicial.
And what your sources clearly showed was this very deliberate, almost dual-front strategy coming out of the White House.
Exactly. On one hand, you had these really high-stakes international diplomatic moves playing out, trying to reshape alliances, deal with conflicts.
And then at the exact same time, this really aggressive push for domestic power consolidation right here at home.
Yeah, targeting the bureaucracy, even local government structures, it was quite something.
And what makes this day so interesting, and why we really dove deep into the sources you sent, is how these big sweeping actions were met almost immediately.
With really robust challenges from the other branches.
Which signals some incredibly deep institutional tensions, things that are frankly reshaping the country as we speak. You sent us just a wealth of information on this past Friday.
Yeah, we've been digging in, looking for those key threads.
So, what strikes you most? How can one single day pack such a punch, affecting so many different parts of government almost instantly?
Well, if we kind of step back and look at the bigger picture of August 15th, it really pulls together three critical themes. Themes that I think will likely define this whole period in governance.
Okay, what are they?
First, you've got this really aggressive assertion of executive power, constantly pushing, testing the limits, constitutionally, statutorily. Second, you see the judiciary stepping up, really emerging as the primary check, often the most immediate check on that executive power. And finally, it just throws into sharp relief the fracturing of international alliances, but also domestic political unity. It wasn't just another Friday.
No, definitely not.
It was more like a comprehensive snapshot, a federal government in dynamic and often very contentious action.
Okay, let's unpack this. Starting with the first major event, the one that really dominated headlines around the world, the U.S.-Russia summit in Anchorage, Alaska.
Yeah, this was positioned as a huge foreign policy move, especially with the backdrop of the war in Ukraine, which by then had been going on for 4 years.
The core event was this direct bilateral summit. President Trump, Russian President Putin, meeting at Joint Base Elmendorf Richardson.
A U.S. military base.
Right. And remember, President Trump had campaigned on that audacious promise to end the Ukraine conflict in 24 hours.
A very bold claim.
And he made it clear before the meeting he wasn't going to be happy without some kind of ceasefire agreement.
Setting expectations.
And interestingly, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent was there too, which strongly hinted that economics, maybe sanctions relief, new trade deals were definitely part of the conversation.
Absolutely. That presence was significant. But what's really fascinating, I think, is the deliberate choreography, the sheer stagecraft of power that went into this whole thing.
How so?
Well, choosing an active U.S. military base in Alaska, that wasn't just random. It was calculated. It projected strength, American strength, but also this kind of veneer of neutrality. Far from D.C., far from Moscow.
Right, trying to give it an air of pragmatic, no-nonsense diplomacy.
Exactly. And the White House, predictably, framed it big. Historic summit, really underscoring its perceived global importance.
And the visuals were key too, weren't they?
Oh, absolutely. Meticulously managed visuals, trying to convey the sense of personal rapport, peer-level respect between the leaders, which, let's be honest, is a huge departure from the diplomatic isolation Putin had faced for most Western nations since the invasion started in 22.
Yeah, for a leader largely treated as a pariah internationally.
Just getting this summit on U.S. soil with this kind of framing, that alone was a significant win for Putin, really, regardless of what was actually agreed upon.
You saw it right away in the optics, like you said, the stagecraft. The two presidents emerging from their planes almost at the same time,
Synchronize.
walking shoulder to shoulder on that red carpet laid out on the tarmac. It looked like a carefully rehearsed entrance.
And even their attire was coordinated. Trump in a ruby red tie, Putin in burgundy. Little details, but they reinforce that image of engagement, maybe even a shared purpose.
And then the big symbolic moment, the shared ride.
Yes. In the U.S. presidential limo, the Beast, whisked away together and seen through the window, casually chatting like reunited friends. That's the quote that circulated.
That kind of warmth, that level of ceremonial treatment, it's usually reserved for the closest allies, right? Not for a leader indicted for war crimes and shunned by much of the world.
Precisely. The whole spectacle felt designed to bypass the normal diplomatic order, to marginalize those traditional foreign policy channels.
Making it seem like conflict resolution was just a personal matter, something to be settled directly between these two powerful men.
And it worked in terms of projecting that image. It wasn't lost on anyone. Neither were the ignored, shouted questions from reporters as they drove off.
Like that one, President Putin, will you stop killing civilians? Just ignored.
All part of a very deliberate, very controlled public relations exercise.
So, okay, they talked for about 2.5 hours. The world is waiting. What's the concrete result? What's the deal?
And here's where it gets, as you said, really interesting. Because there wasn't one. No concrete public agreement announced at all.
Instead, we got these deliberately vague, almost conflicting statements from the two leaders.
Exactly. Trump's messaging, publicly at least, was quite cautious. He said, there's no deal until there's a deal.
And then he told Fox News later, it's not a done deal at all.
Right. He did acknowledge that many, many points were agreed on, but also admitted a couple of big ones were still unresolved. Painting this picture of tough, ongoing talks gave him room to maneuver.
But Putin's message was quite different.
Oh, strategically very different. He claimed they'd reached an understanding on Ukraine. And then, crucially, he aimed a warning shot at European nations,
saying they shouldn't torpedo the nascent progress.
Precisely. And in his formal statement afterwards, Putin mostly skipped the war details. He focused instead on this narrative of shared U.S.-Russian history, like their WWII alliance.
Looking backward and forward.
Yeah, and the potential for future economic cooperation, things like Arctic development, space exploration. He made a point of praising Trump, too, calling him a leader who sincerely cares about the prosperity of his nation, but also understands that Russia has its own national interests.
So painting Russia as the reasonable one.
Completely. Trying to portray Russia as seeking to turn the page and go back to cooperation, which cleverly shifts the blame for any future diplomatic breakdown onto Ukraine or its European allies. It's a classic maneuver so division, apply pressure.
So that divergence in messaging, it wasn't necessarily a sign of diplomatic failure.
Not at all. I think it was a really sophisticated tactic, especially for Putin. His understanding claim was aimed right at Europe,
creating the impression that peace was close. And if it failed, it was someone else's fault.
Exactly. Weakens European unity, puts immense pressure on Kyiv to maybe make unilateral concessions.
Well, Trump's no deal line played to his base back home.
Perfectly. Let him keep that image as the tough negotiator, the one who wouldn't accept a bad deal, who could walk away.
So the combined effect is strategic chaos.
I think that's a good way to put it. Strategic chaos. It forces U.S. allies into this uncomfortable position, what was actually agreed behind those closed doors. It breeds suspicion, weakens their unified front.
And leaves Ukraine potentially negotiating from a position of fear, worried about some secret deal being struck over their heads.
Precisely. This ambiguity is a powerful tool. It destabilizes existing alliances, creates leverage for both Washington and Moscow, frankly.
And the reactions were, well, predictable in their division. Immediate, sharp.
Exposing those deep divides domestically and internationally.
Congressional Democrats were out criticizing it almost immediately. Senator Jeanne Shaheen, Democrat New Hampshire, ranking member on foreign relations.
Yeah, she issued a really scathing statement.
Accused Trump of being played yet again by Putin. Said he got nothing concrete in return for, quote, rolling out the red carpet for a murderous dictator on American soil.
Yeah.
Strong words.
Very strong. She warned that Trump's reluctance to hold Putin accountable means Ukrainians will continue to die. Putin acts without consequence, and it even weakens deterrence against China.
And she called for Congress to pass crushing sanctions when they returned, signaling a real legislative pushback brewing.
And this whole thing raises a really important question, doesn't it? What happened to that principle of nothing about Ukraine without Ukraine?
Right. Zelensky wasn't there. He wasn't part of these direct talks.
Which is a major break from long-standing Western policy, hugely concerning for Kyiv, especially given the memory of that earlier, reportedly very acrimonious meeting between Trump and Zelensky,
where Trump supposedly yelled at him about gambling with World War III.
Exactly. So the friendly optics in Alaska, combined with that ambiguous outcome, it just fueled fears in Kyiv and across Europe that their security could be compromised, maybe even traded away, in some bilateral deal they weren't privy to.
And strategic analysts seem to agree that this was a win for Putin.
Largely, yes. The consensus was that the meeting itself was a major victory for Putin. It broke that diplomatic boycott he'd faced since 2022.
Gave him legitimacy just by being there, negotiating directly with the U.S. president about Ukraine's fate.
And seemingly without Russia having to offer any real tangible concessions up front, it rewarded Moscow's intransigence, potentially emboldened them.
And it strongly suggests a potential U.S. strategic pivot, doesn't it? Away from that unified transatlantic approach.
Definitely. The very fact it was bilateral, so personalized, signals a move away from the multilateral approach that's defined Western policy towards Russia for decades.
It positions Trump as the central figure, sidelining NATO, sidelining the EU.
Which have always been crucial in presenting that united front. Now, this might give the U.S. some unique leverage, perhaps.
But it undeniably sows discord within the Western alliance, which, let's face it, has always been a strategic goal for the Kremlin.
Absolutely. This single summit could have ripple effects for years, forcing allies to rethink their own strategies, their reliance on the U.S.
So while all this international drama was unfolding in Alaska, the administration wasn't exactly quiet on the home front. They were making equally assertive, maybe even more controversial moves right here.
Indeed. While the world's eyes were on the summit, the executive branch was very busy trying to solidify domestic control. Looking at your sources, two recent really sweeping executive actions stand out. And when you look at them together, they paint a clear picture.
A picture of what?
Of a concerted, aggressive effort to centralize power, to bypass established norms within the U.S. government itself.
Okay, let's dig into the first one. The ongoing federal takeover, and that's really what it felt like, of the D.C. Metropolitan Police Department, the MPD.
This is truly unprecedented stuff.
It kicked off just a few days before, August 11th, with Executive Order 14,333, boldly titled, Declaring a Crime Emergency in the District of Columbia.
Now, the federal government always has a unique role in D.C., of course, but a direct operational takeover of the local police force like this, it's never happened before.
And the legal justification they used.
Ah, that's crucial. They invoked Section 740 of the D.C. Home Rule Act of 1973. Now, this section does allow the president to assume control of the MPD for federal purposes during special conditions of an emergency nature.
Okay, so there's a legal basis, technically.
Technically. But here's the kicker, the reason this is so unprecedented. In the entire 52-year history of D.C. having home rule, that specific provision had never been used. Not once.
Not for riots, protests, other crime waves?
Never. This was a legal first, really pushing the boundaries of what that Home Rule Act was intended to allow.
So what was the administration's stated reason? Why invoke this now?
Their justification was this supposed precipitous rise in violent crime. They claimed it was endangering public servants, tourists, the basic functioning of the federal government.
Tainting a pretty dire picture.
Oh, yeah. Public statements describe the Capitol as being under siege from violent crime, even calling it a point of national disgrace.
Yeah.
That was the narrative used to justify immediate dramatic federal intervention.
But was that narrative actually true? Was the premise accurate?
Well, that immediately became the central point of contention. Local officials, critics, they pushed back hard. They pointed to official MPD statistics.
And what did those show?
They showed violent crime in the district had actually been decreasing for the past 2 years and had recently hit a 30-year low.
So the official data directly contradicted the administration's justification for the emergency.
Directly. Which fueled accusations that this wasn't about a real crime crisis at all, that it was a politically manufactured pretext, a way to assert federal control over a city government often at odds with the administration. The factual basis was shaky, to say the least.
And the way they implemented it was pretty sweeping too, wasn't it? The details show real intent for a full takeover.
Absolutely granular detail. On August 14th, Attorney General Pam Bondi issued a direct order to put the EO into action. She appointed the head of the DEA, Terrence Cole, as the emergency police commissioner.
Giving him.
The order claimed to give him all of the powers and duties vested in the District of Columbia Chief of Police, essentially pushing aside the city's own chief, Pamela Smith.
And who's overseeing this?
The U.S. Marshal Service, under Director Gaddy Serralta, explicitly tasked with supervising command and control. Clearly a top-down federal command structure being imposed.
And the order went further. targeting local policies.
Yes. It explicitly aimed to rescind certain local MPD policies, like those limiting cooperation with federal immigration authorities. And it directed officers to enforce federal priorities, like clearing homeless encampments.
And there was the National Guard involvement, too.
Right. A separate presidential memo mobilized the D.C. National Guard to support these law enforcement efforts across the city, further federalizing the whole public safety apparatus.
Okay, so that's the D.C. situation. But you said there was a second major domestic action unfolding around the same time.
Yes. Parallel to this direct intervention in D.C., the administration was also moving to assert control over the vast machinery of federal funding. The full impact of an executive order issued just a week earlier, on August 7th, improving oversight of federal grant making was really starting to hit home for researchers and nonprofits around August 15th.
And this one changes how federal grants are awarded. Billions of dollars.
Fundamentally alters the process. It shifts the whole basis of decision making away from the traditional merit-based peer review.
Towards what?
Towards political alignment. It's a massive shift. Affects everything from climate change research grants to funding for social programs, university research, you name it.
So instead of scientists or experts in a field deciding what research gets funded based on its merit,
it's political appointees making the call. That's the core mechanism. The order mandates that every federal agency designate one or more senior appointees, political officials, to review and approve all discretionary grant awards and even the announcements seeking proposals.
And their job is to ensure.
To ensure all funding is consistent with agency priorities and the national interest, crucially as defined by the president's policy priorities.
Which effectively sidelines the peer review system, the one that's been used for decades.
Exactly. That system where subject matter experts, often independent academics, evaluate proposals based on scientific rigor or need. It's being pushed aside, replaced by political vetting.
And the order included ideological tests, too, explicit ones.
Yes, very explicit. It outright prohibits using grant funds for projects perceived to fund, promote, encourage, subsidize, or facilitate certain topics.
Like what?
Things like racial preferences, the denial by the grant recipient of the sex binary in humans, or illegal immigration, very specific culture war points.
And it prioritized certain kinds of science.
It directed agencies to prioritize what it calls gold standard science, a term the administration has linked to its own policy agenda, often interpreted as research that directly supports its political aims.
Implicitly sidelining other areas, like climate change, social equity research.
That's the concern. Research deemed less aligned might lose out. And it also pushed agencies to favor institutions with lower indirect cost rates.
What does that mean in practice?
It puts financial pressure on major research universities. They rely on those indirect cost rates to cover essential overhead labs, libraries, administration. Lowering those rates squeezes their budgets.
But you mentioned perhaps the most powerful tool in this order, the termination for convenience clause.
Yes. This is maybe the most impactful and critics would say insidious part. The order requires that all discretionary grants must now include this clause,
allowing the government to cancel a grant at any time.
Exactly. Not for cause like fraud or failure to perform, but simply if the grant no longer advances agency priorities or the national interest. And critically, it applies not just to new grants, but is supposed to be retroactively applied to existing ones where possible.
Wow, that completely changes the game for anyone receiving federal funding.
Fundamentally alters the relationship. Traditionally, a grant is like a contract for a set period. You can only lose it for clear reasons.
But termination for convenience means it could be pulled just because political priorities shift.
Precisely. Imagine you're a university halfway through a multi-year climate study. A new official comes in, decides that research isn't in the national interest anymore. Boom, funding gone.
That creates massive instability, uncertainty.
Huge amounts. And the mere risk of it happening, that creates a powerful chilling effect.
How so?
Institutions will be incentivized to just avoid controversial research topics altogether, to self-censor their work, basically, to make sure they align with whatever the current political winds are, just to keep the lights on.
So it achieves ideological control through financial pressure rather than direct censorship.
Exactly. It's subtle, but incredibly effective at steering research and advocacy in politically favored directions.
Okay, so let's connect these two dots. So DC police takeover and this grant oversight order. They happened around the same time. Are they isolated? or is there a common thread?
Oh, they are definitely not isolated incidents. When you look at them together, they reveal a single coherent strategy, a campaign, really.
To do what?
To override local and institutional autonomy, to enforce political loyalty across different levels of government and society.
So the DC order replaces local democratic control with federal command?
Under the Attorney General, yes. And the grants order replaces independent scientific judgment with the approval of political appointees reporting to the White House.
In both cases, authority is stripped from independent bodies.
And placed directly into the hands of political actors accountable to the administration. The stated goal, right there in the grants order, is to ensure everything demonstrably advances the president's policy priorities.
And the DC takeover, based on that disputed emergency,
is like a practical application of that principle. Applied to public safety, it signals a willingness to use almost any pretext, however thin, to assert control.
So it establishes a pattern, using executive power to subordinate any entity, a city government, a scientific body that seems unaligned.
That's exactly the pattern it establishes. A clear assertion of centralized executive power over perceived opposition.
Okay, so we've seen assertive executive action both abroad and at home. Now, how was the legislative branch, Congress, reacting and acting on the same day, August 15th?
Well, moving over to Capitol Hill, August 15th really painted a stark picture of just how polarized Congress was. It felt like the two parties were operating in completely separate universes.
Focused on totally different things.
Completely different priorities, responding to events in ways that barely seemed to acknowledge the other side's reality. It definitely wasn't a day for compromise or finding common ground.
More like each side digging in on its own agenda and pushing back against the other.
Exactly. A day of policy promotion on one side and political counteroffensives on the other.
So on the Republican side, the big focus was celebrating the One Big Beautiful Bill, or OBBA, which had just become law.
Right. This was clearly the cornerstone of the administration's second-term economic plan.
And the main piece of that bill was making the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, the TCJA individual income tax cuts, permanent.
That was the biggest part, yes. Those cuts were originally set to expire at the end of 2025, so making them permanent was a massive policy decision. Huge implications for revenue and deficits.
But OBBA did more than just extend the TCJA cuts, right? It added some new temporary deductions.
It did. For the tax years 2025 through 2028, it introduced some specific new breaks.
Like what?
Things like a deduction up to $25,000 for qualified tip income, up to $12,500 for qualified overtime pay, up to $10,000 for interest paid on new car loans for personal use.
And something for seniors.
Yeah, an additional $6,000 deduction for people 65 and older. Though it's important to note, all these new deductions came with income phase-outs, so they weren't universal. A very targeted approach to tax relief.
And Republicans, especially folks like House Ways and Means Chairman Jason Smith from Missouri, were really pushing this hard, weren't they?
Aggressively promoting it, framing it as this huge win for the working class, putting money back in people's pockets.
And contrasting it with the previous administration's Inflation Reduction Act.
Exactly. Claiming OBBA dismantled what they called welfare for the wealthy in the IRA. It was a clear political victory lap narrative they were pushing.
Now, a really significant part of OBBA, maybe the most controversial, was the energy policy reversal.
Oh, hugely significant, and generated enormous debate. The bill repealed an estimated $500 billion in what the administration dismissively called Green New Deal subsidies.
What did that include specifically?
It meant the immediate end of tax credits for luxury electric vehicles, a direct hit against EV adoption incentives. And critically, it terminated the permanent tax credits for wind and solar energy projects that had been a cornerstone of the IRA.
So a clear legislative effort to shift investment.
Away from renewables and back towards traditional fossil fuels. A complete 180-degree turn from the previous administration's climate and energy policies. Major ideological shift.
But as often happens, the political promotion didn't quite match the independent analyses of the bill's impact.
Well, this definitely raises that important question. What's the spin versus the reality? Independent, nonpartisan bodies painted a very different picture.
Like the Congressional Budget Office, the CBO.
Right. The CBO projected that OBBA would add a staggering $4.1 trillion to federal budget deficits over the next 10 years, 2025 to 2034. That's a massive number.
And what about who benefits? The working class claim.
Analysis from the Tax Policy Center, another respected nonpartisan group, concluded the opposite, that the provisions were highly regressive.
Meaning the benefits flowed upwards.
Overwhelmingly, they found the largest benefits, both in actual dollars and as a percentage of after-tax income, went to the highest income households.
Can you give an example?
Sure. They estimated that folks in the 95th to 99th income percentile would see an average tax cut of around $21,000 in 2026. Middle income households, their average cut was estimated at about $1,800.
So despite the rhetoric, the data suggested the biggest winners were at the top.
That's what the independent analyses indicated, yes.
Okay, so while the Republican majority was celebrating ODDA, the Democratic minority was focused elsewhere, consumed by responding to the executive branch's actions.
Absolutely. This perfectly illustrates that fractured Congress we talked about. While one side was focused on its economic agenda, the other was scrambling to react to the DC police situation.
Their immediate response was a joint resolution.
Yes. Leading Democrats introduced it right away, aimed squarely at terminating the president's emergency declaration over DC and ending that federalization of the MPD. It was their urgent countermove.
And this effort was led by some prominent names.
Yes, people like Representative Jamie Raskin from Maryland, Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes, Norton, DC's own delegate Representative Robert Garcia from California, and Senator Chris Van Hollen from Maryland. A coordinated pushback.
And what was their main legal argument against the president's DC action?
Their core argument was precise. They called it unlawful federalization. They argued the president had failed to identify the necessary special conditions of an emergency nature that the Home Rule Act actually requires.
So challenging the very premise of the emergency.
Exactly. They called the takeover unprecedented, dangerous, and disgraceful. A violation of DC's right to self-govern, a hostile takeover, they said, based on a false narrative about crime rates.
Arguing he was bypassing the city's elected officials and police chief without legitimate cause.
Precisely. It was an immediate legislative challenge, reflecting deep concern about federal overreach into local affairs.
Now, beyond these big partisan fights over OBBBA in DC, was there other activity in Congress on August 15th? Anything less dramatic?
Well, the U.S. Senate, interestingly, convened only for a very brief pro forma session.
Pro forma? What does that actually mean in practice?
It's essentially a meeting in name only, very brief, often just minutes long. No real legislative work gets done.
So why do it?
Its main purpose is technical. It satisfies the constitutional requirement that the Senate remain technically in session. This prevents the president from making certain types of appointments called recess appointments while Congress is formally adjourned.
So the fact they only held a pro forma session on a day with so much happening.
It really underscores the gridlock. It shows that despite all these major federal events swirling around, the Senate itself wasn't actively legislating or debating that day. Highlights a certain inertia, even amidst the polarization.
Okay, shifting back to foreign policy for a moment, but within Congress, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee wasn't totally silent. Senator Shaheen issued another statement.
Right. Besides her critique of the Alaska summit, Ranking Member Shaheen also put out a formal statement about Lebanon.
Commending Lebanon's government for deciding to ensure the state has a monopoly over weapons.
Exactly. Which is a really crucial point for upholding UN resolutions and the Taif Agreement, the deal that ended Lebanon's civil war. And it's implicitly aimed at reining in non-state actors like Hezbollah.
And she praised specific Lebanese leaders. And threatened sanctions.
Yes. She praised President Joseph Aoun and Prime Minister Nawaf Salam. And she included a clear warning threatening U.S. sanctions against anyone undermining this progress towards state control over arms.
So if we connect this back to the bigger picture, like you did with the summit critique, this statement about Lebanon isn't just routine diplomacy.
I don't think so. It's subtle, but it's significant. It's an assertion of that traditional alliance-based, rules-based American foreign policy.
A direct contrast to the very personal bilateral approach seen in Alaska.
Exactly. By praising a government for upholding international agreements and threatening sanctions against spoilers, she's sending a clear signal.
To who?
To international partners, especially those feeling nervous or sidelined by the Trump-Putin summit. It's saying, look, an alternative vision of American foreign policy still exists within the U.S. system, one based on international law, institutions, and working with allies. It's a form of reassurance.
Okay, this deeply fractured Congress, the assertive executive, it all leads us directly to the third branch, the judiciary, which on August 15th really proved to be the most immediate and maybe the most effective check on that executive power we've been talking about.
Absolutely. The courts became the main stage for direct confrontation. We saw the administration's assertive actions run smack into the established rule of law, and the courts delivered some pretty significant blows to the administration's agenda, all on that one day.
Let's start with the DC police situation again, but this time in court. DC's Attorney General, Brian Schwalb, didn't waste any time, did he?
Not at all. He filed a lawsuit first thing on the morning of August 15th, right in federal court.
The case was District of Columbia v. Trump et al.
That's right. And it sought an immediate block on the administration's takeover actions.
Arguing what?
Arguing they went way beyond the president's limited authority under the Home Rule Act, and that they violated both the Administrative Procedure Act, the APA, and the Constitution itself.
In lay names, Trump, Bondi?
Yes. The suit named President Trump, Attorney General Bondi, and other key federal officials. A direct legal challenge aimed right at the top.
And an emergency hearing happened that same day, before U.S. District Judge Ana Reyes.
Yes, things moved incredibly quickly. The hearing lasted for hours. And right from the bench, Judge Reyes expressed, let's just say, profound skepticism about the legality of the administration trying to completely displace the local police command.
Her questions and comments suggested she wasn't buying the administration's interpretation of the Home Rule Act.
Not at all. She seemed to be leaning towards a very narrow reading of that emergency provision, basically saying it allowed for cooperation maybe, but not outright federal control.
And there was that key quote from her during the hearing.
Yes, it really captured her thinking. "The way I read the statute," she said, "the president can ask, the mayor must provide, but the president can't control."
Pretty clear signal. The president could request MPD help for federal needs in an emergency, but couldn't just take over the department or fire its chief.
That was the strong implication, a critical early sign that the administration might have seriously overstepped its legal authority.
So facing that clear pushback from the judge, the administration blinked.
They executed a partial but definitely significant retreat later that day. Administration lawyers essentially reversed course on their most extreme step.
Which was?
They agreed to leave MPD Chief Pamela Smith in operational control of her department.
Which effectively canceled that part of Bondi's order, appointing the DEA administrator as emergency commissioner.
Exactly. Nullified the order that tried to strip Chief Smith of her job. It was a major concession forced by the judicial resistance.
But they didn't completely back down. The emergency declaration itself stayed.
No, they didn't fully capitulate. Attorney General Bondi issued a new memo. It kept the underlying emergency declaration in place, and it included a new directive.
Ordering the MPD to do what?
To cooperate fully with federal immigration enforcement, regardless of any conflicting D.C. city laws or policies.
So they backed off the full operational takeover, but were still determined to use the emergency declaration to force their policy priorities onto D.C. in other ways.
That seems to be the case. A tactical retreat on one front, but continued pressure on another.
Okay, meanwhile, on that same packed day, August 15th, news broke about another big legal setback for the administration. This one related to their anti-DEI agenda. Diversity, equity, and inclusion.
Yes, another definitive legal defeat. This ruling had actually been issued the day before, August 14th, but the news really spread on the 15th. It came from U.S. District Judge Stephanie Gallagher in Maryland.
What did she rule?
She granted summary judgment to the plaintiffs, struck down the Department of Education's anti-DEI guidance nationwide, a huge blow to a core ideological goal of the administration.
Remind us what that guidance did.
It came out in memos earlier in the year, February and April 2025, and it threatened to pull federal funding from K-12 schools and universities if they kept DEI programs going.
Based on what argument?
The department argued that the Supreme Court's 2023 decision banning affirmative action in college admissions should be read really broadly. Broadly enough to prohibit almost any consideration of race in education hiring, financial aid, even classroom teaching.
That was an aggressive interpretation.
Very aggressive, designed to force a significant rollback of DEI initiatives everywhere in education.
And Judge Gallagher rejected it. On what grounds?
Primarily on procedural grounds. She found the administration had violated the Administrative Procedure Act, the APA.
How so?
She said the guidance wasn't just clarifying existing law, as the department claimed. It was a sea change in policy, a whole new legislative rule, essentially.
Which means they needed to follow a formal process.
Exactly. The formal notice and comment rulemaking process, which involves public input, takes time. They hadn't done that. They just issued memos.
Did she raise constitutional concerns, too?
She did. She found the guidance likely violated the Constitution on substance as well. Because its language was so vague, it didn't clearly define what DEI practices were actually prohibited.
Creating a chilling effect.
Yes, a chilling effect on free speech. Institutions might self-censor or get rid of perfectly legal programs just out of fear of losing funding because the rules were unclear. She suggested it might be void for vagueness under the Due Process Clause.
How did people react to the ruling?
Well, the plaintiffs, including the American Federation of Teachers, the AFT, were thrilled, called it a huge win for students, families, and educators.
And the Education Department.
They issued a statement expressing disappointment, naturally, but they also asserted the ruling wouldn't stop them from enforcing Title VI anti-discrimination laws, signaling, you know, the fight wasn't necessarily over, more legal battles likely ahead.
So beyond these two really big cases, D.C. police, DEI guidance, was there other notable court activity on August 15th? Just showing the breadth of the judiciary's work.
Yeah, a couple of other things worth mentioning briefly. The U.S. Supreme Court issued a short, unsigned order in a case called NetChoice, LLC v. Fitch.
What was that about?
It involved a Mississippi law restricting social media access for minors. The court, acting on its emergency docket, allowed the law to stay in effect for now, while the main lawsuit challenging it continues in the lower courts.
Any hints about how the court might eventually rule?
Interestingly, yes. Justice Brett Kavanaugh wrote a separate concurrence. He suggested the Mississippi law was actually likely unconstitutional on First Amendment free speech grounds.
But he voted to let it stay in effect anyway. Why?
He argued the tech industry group challenging the law hadn't shown enough irreparable harm would occur immediately to justify an emergency injunction blocking the law right now. It highlights the ongoing struggle courts face applying old constitutional principles like free speech to new digital technologies. How do you balance protecting kids versus online expression? It's tough.
And there was a D.C. Circuit Court decision, too.
Yes, a decision involving the National Treasury Employees Union and the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the CFPB. Just another reminder of the constant legal battles over the structure and power of independent federal agencies, often involving labor rights versus regulatory authority.
So, stepping back, what does all this judicial activity on one day tell us, especially the big rulings against the administration?
What's really fascinating, I think, is how the Administrative Procedure Act, the APA, has become such a key tool, a primary bulwark against these rapid unilateral executive policy changes.
How does it work as a bulwark?
Well, the administration is clearly trying to make big changes fast, using executive orders, agency guidance memos. It's quicker than going through Congress.
Right. Bypasses the legislative gridlock.
But the courts, in both the DEI case and implicitly in the DC police case too, are saying, hold on, these aren't just minor interpretations, these are major rule changes.
And if they're major rule changes,
then the APA kicks in. Specifically, the requirement for that formal public notice and comment rulemaking process, which takes time, allows public input, forces the agency to justify its reasoning.
So it forces the administration into a choice. Slow down and follow the process, or risk getting overturned in court.
Exactly. Speed versus legal defensibility.
Yeah.
The judiciary is using proceduralism, a largely neutral legal tool, to effectively slow down and restrain executive action, forcing a more deliberate pace.
Now, you raised this important question earlier, and it's worth revisiting. What does it really mean that Judge Gallagher, who struck down the DEI guidance, was actually appointed by President Trump?
It's highly significant. It demonstrates very clearly that these legal challenges aren't just knee-jerk partisan opposition.
They're grounded in actual legal principles, like administrative law, the First Amendment.
Precisely. Principles that can and do command agreement across the ideological spectrum within the judiciary. It really pushes back against that simplistic narrative that judges just vote based on the party of the president who appointed them.
So it refutes the idea of a rubber-stamped judiciary.
Strongly. Judge Gallagher applying established legal principles, even when it went against the administration that put her on the bench. That sends a powerful message about judicial independence. It reaffirms that the rule of law, especially procedural rules and constitutional limits, still acts as a real constraint on executive power, regardless of who appointed the judge.
And it might embolden other judges.
It certainly could. Seeing a fellow judge, even one appointed by the current administration, uphold these principles might encourage others to scrutinize similar executive actions just as carefully.
Okay, so we've covered the summit, the domestic executive orders, Congress's reaction, the court battles. But beyond those high-profile clashes, The administrative state itself, the bureaucracy, was incredibly busy on August 15th too, wasn't it? Often working behind the scenes.
Absolutely. While the headlines were screaming about Alaska and lawsuits, the vast machinery of the administrative state was plugging away, translating those broader policy goals we've discussed into the nitty-gritty rules and regulations that actually govern our economy and the government itself. This is where policy really hits the pavement.
Let's talk about one major example you flagged from the sources.
Yeah.
This revolutionary FAR overhaul. Now, FAR stands for Federal Acquisition Regulation.
That's right. It's the massive rulebook that dictates how the federal government buys basically everything from pens and paper to fighter jets and complex IT systems.
And this overhaul was billed as the biggest reform to federal procurement in over 40 years.
Yes, announced by the White House Office of Management and Budget's Procurement Policy Office, OFPP. It's positioned as a cornerstone of the administration's whole deregulatory agenda.
What's the stated goal?
To streamline how the government buys things. Make it faster, more efficient, supposedly more accessible, especially for small businesses or innovative tech companies that often find the current system too complex and burdensome to navigate.
So how does this overhaul try to achieve that? What are the key pieces?
Well, first, there's massive deregulation baked in. Agencies are now authorized to immediately just eliminate up to one-third the contractual requirements they impose, as long as those requirements aren't explicitly mandated by a law or another executive order.
It's so cutting red tape.
A lot of it. The FAR Council apparently already identified over 500 requirements for potential relief, with a goal of getting rid of over 1,000 eventually. They're also undertaking this huge project to rewrite the entire FAR using plain language.
To make it less like legalese, easier to understand.
Exactly. Reduce ambiguity, make it clearer for businesses, especially smaller ones, what they need to do.
Any other big changes? Modernization.
Yes. They're getting rid of clearly outdated requirements, things like needing paper-based price lists in a digital age. They're consolidating procedures under a modernized section, FIR Part 8, and retiring older, clunkier parts like 38 and 51.
And trying to centralize contracting.
Right. Directing agencies to use more government-wide contracts, things designated best in class or preferred for common goods and services, instead of each agency having its own duplicative, inefficient contracts for the same things.
So this FIR overhaul, it sounds technical, but it's more than just tweaking the rules.
Oh, much more. It's really a strategic effort to fundamentally reshape the government's relationship with the private sector. It clearly emphasizes market-based approaches, reduces administrative burdens. It reflects a whole philosophy about the role of government and business.
Okay, now connecting back to legislation on August 15th, the administrative state was also busy implementing that new law, the OBBBA, the One Big Beautiful Bill. How did that show up?
Yes. The Internal Revenue Service, the IRS, got right to work. On August 15th, they released something called Notice 2025-42.
And this notice provided guidance on?
On how wind and solar energy projects can prove they've begun construction in time to qualify for the clean energy tax credit.
Which is critical because OBBA dramatically changed those credits. Roll back the ones from the Inflation Reduction Act.
Exactly. This IRS notice is a direct, immediate consequence of that new law. It had to clarify the new rules of the game.
And what do the new guidance say? How do projects prove they've begun construction now?
It lays out the specific types of physical work that will qualify. But the really notable change is that it eliminates something called the 5% safe harbor for most projects.
What was the 5% safe harbor?
It was a previous rule that allowed developers to qualify for the credits relatively easily just by spending 5% of the project's total estimated cost. It gave them certainty early on.
And now that's gone.
Mostly gone. The new IRS guidance demands more concrete, actual physical work to have started on the ground. It makes it significantly harder, requires more upfront investment for projects to lock in those crucial tax credits.
Effectively tightening the eligibility for renewable energy projects, making it harder to qualify.
That's the practical effect, yes. It clearly reflects the policy shift away from subsidizing renewables embedded in OBBBA.
So this kind of detailed rulemaking by an agency like the IRS is absolutely essential, isn't it, to translate a broad policy change made by Congress into something concrete and enforceable.
Absolutely. It shows how laws passed by Congress still need the administrative state, the bureaucracy, to actually flesh them out and give them teeth in the real world. Policy doesn't implement itself.
Now, just to give people a sense of the sheer scale of what the administrative state does every single day, even amidst all this high drama, let's look at the Federal Register for August 15th.
Right, the government's daily journal of record.
On that one day, Friday, August 15th, 2025, How many documents were filed?
A total of 111 new documents from 39 different federal agencies, all filed for public inspection, getting ready for official publication.
And that included
12 final rules making policy official, 3 proposed rules seeking public comment, and 94 notices covering everything else.
Can you give a few examples, just the range of topics?
Sure. You had things like airworthiness directives from the FAA, critical for flight safety, notices about emergency commodity assistance from the Department of Agriculture dealing with food security, a notice from the Commerce Department about procedures for the Section 232 steel and aluminum tariffs affecting global trade, even a proposed rule from the Department of Education about federal student loans impacting millions of borrowers.
Wow. It's just a reminder of the incredible breadth of what the federal government does day in and day out.
And what's fascinating is that despite all the high-level political conflict, the summit, the lawsuits, this essential work of governance just keeps grinding on, regulating commerce, ensuring safety, running programs. Across this huge range of functions, much of it operates relatively independently of the political storms at the top.
So bringing this section together, the FAR overhaul, the IRS guidance, the sheer volume in the Federal Register, what does it tell us about the administration's overall approach to the administrative state?
Well, if we connect it to the bigger picture, these actions reveal a really nuanced strategy. It's not just a simple war on the administrative state or the so-called deep state, as some portray it.
It's more sophisticated than that.
I think so. It looks more like a strategic, multi-pronged effort to actively remold the administrative state, to harness its immense power for the administration's own purposes.
A dual-track approach.
Exactly.
Yeah.
On one track, you have confrontational measures like the Grant EO, the DC police move designed to bypass or subordinate parts of the bureaucracy perceived as oppositional or unaligned.
And on the other track.
On the other, you see constructive engagement like the FAR overhaul, the IRS guidance implementing OBBA, using the bureaucracy's own tools to implement core policy objectives.
So, using deregulation to win business support.
Using detailed rulemaking to cement legislative wins.
And using raw executive power to force ideological conformity where laws don't exist or Congress won't act.
Precisely. It's a very comprehensive approach. Using every lever available, confrontation, co-option, regulation, deregulation, to steer the ship of state in its desired direction.
Okay, we've taken a really granular look at Friday, August 15th, a truly dynamic, almost frenetic day across the U.S. government. So let's try to synthesize. What does this all mean looking forward? What are the key takeaways from this incredibly packed 24 hours?
Yeah, it's important to step back and see the patterns. This day wasn't just a random collection of events. It really showcased a clear, coherent governing philosophy and a distinct strategic approach to wielding power. I think we can pull out 3 interconnected, overarching themes from everything that happened on August 15th.
Okay, theme number 1.
The clear primacy of executive power. The day was just overwhelmingly dominated by the president using executive authority to drive the agenda.
From the personally conducted summit in Alaska.
To the rapid-fire executive orders, the direct commands given to cabinet agencies, the White House was undeniably the central engine of policy.
And this approach consistently pushed the boundaries. Tested limits.
Absolutely. Constantly testing perceived constitutional and statutory limits. We saw it with the unprecedented use of the DC Home Rule Act's emergency clause. We saw it with the sweeping grant-making overhaul done without legislation or normal procedure.
So it signals a governance model that values
speed, ideological purity, prioritizing those over consensus building, over traditional legislative deliberation, a very top-down executive-centric approach.
Okay, theme number 2.
The judiciary stepping up as the primary arena of resistance.
With Congress often gridlocked.
Exactly. With Congress often paralyzed by partisanship and unable to react quickly, the most significant, most effective checks on those executive actions came from the federal courts, not from Capitol Hill.
The DC police case, the DEI guidance ruling.
Those demonstrate the court's critical role, acting as arbiters of procedural regularity, constitutional limits, and the focus on the Administrative Procedure Act, the APA in particular, that's established a key legal battleground.
Forcing the administration to deal with established processes.
Right. It positions the judiciary as the main, often the first, venue for institutional resistance to the administration's agenda, which of course highlights why judicial appointments become so incredibly critical.
And the third theme you saw emerging from August 15th.
The administration's clear capacity and willingness to wage a two-front political war simultaneously,
yeah,
meaning engaging in high-stakes international diplomacy abroad, while at the same time fighting intense domestic, cultural, and political battles here at home.
The Alaska Summit, happening alongside the D.C. police federalization, the DEI push, the grant changes.
That juxtaposition isn't accidental. It suggests a strategic calculation that both fronts are essential, maybe even mutually reinforcing.
How so?
Well, foreign policy can be used to project strength, project deal-making on the world stage. While domestic policy works to consolidate control, reward allies, confront opponents at home,
allowing them to drive the news cycle across different areas.
Exactly. Maintain momentum, dictate the narrative on both global and domestic fronts, a very encompassing strategy.
Okay, so those are the themes. Now, the big question, what are the potential long-term impacts? What lasting effects might flow from the events of just this one day, August 15th, 2025?
Yeah, this raises that crucial forward-looking question. Let's break it down. For U.S. alliances, the Alaska Summit, it likely kicks off a period of real uncertainty, heightened stress, especially in transatlantic relations.
Because of the bilateral nature. Excluding allies.
Precisely.
Yeah.
That deliberate exclusion of European partners of Ukraine itself forces allies to question the reliability of U.S. commitment of that traditional collaborative approach.
So they might start hedging their bets.
It's very possible. They might feel the need to hedge against a potential U.S.-Russia deal struck over their heads. Maybe pursue more independent diplomatic tracks with Moscow, even with Tibching.
Which could ultimately weaken Western unity.
That's the real danger. It could fray the cohesion of the Western alliance, the very thing that's underpinned global stability for decades.
Okay. Impact on alliances. What about domestic governance? Federalism, the D.C. conflict.
Well, even though the administration partially retreated in the face of the court challenge, the initial willingness to use that contested emergency declaration to impose federal will on a city, that sets a really contentious precedent.
Could it be replicated elsewhere? In other cities seen as politically opposed?
That's the fear. Could we see similar federal interventions based on disputed emergencies in other Democratic-led urban centers? It certainly makes the federal courts an even more crucial battleground over federalism, over local autonomy, over home rule.
Potentially leading to a real patchwork of governance across the country, redefining the federal-local balance.
That's the potential long-term consequence, yes. A significant shift in that balance.
And what about the research and nonprofit sector? That grant oversight executive order?
That EO looks set to trigger a period of really profound instability for them. Universities, scientific institutes, nonprofits, they're facing immense financial pressure.
From the new indirect cost rules and especially that termination for convenience threat.
Exactly. That constant threat of having funding pulled not for cause, but for political reasons. It creates that powerful chilling effect we talked about on research in sensitive areas, climate, public health, social equity, anything deemed politically inconvenient.
So what's the likely response?
Well, first, expect a wave of litigation. Challenges to the legality, the constitutionality of the EO itself, likely focusing on the procedural flaws, the vagueness.
And longer term, strategically.
Longer term, major institutions will feel forced to diversify their funding, to become less reliant on federal grants that now seem so politically conditioned, so unstable.
Which could impact America's standing in research.
It absolutely could. It might diminish America's global leadership in cutting-edge science and innovation if federal funding becomes seen as unreliable or politically toxic.
Finally, the U.S. economy and fiscal policy. The impact of OBBEA becoming law.
Well, the full effects will obviously play out over months and years. Making the 2017 tax cuts permanent does provide some certainty, yes.
But the cost? That CBO projection.
That projected $4.1 trillion addition to the national debt over 10 years, that becomes a massive, unavoidable issue for future budget debates.
Intensifying pressure for spending cuts elsewhere.
Inevitably. Especially in non-defense programs, potentially entitlements, to try and offset that huge drop in revenue. It forces incredibly difficult policy choices down the road.
And the energy provisions. Rolling back the green credits.
That will fundamentally reshape investment flows in the energy sector. Capital will likely shift away from renewables and towards traditional fossil fuels.
With long-term consequences for it.
For both the economy and the environment, making climate goals potentially much harder to reach. A significant redirection of the nation's energy future. So as we wrap up this deep dive into August 15th, 2025, here's something to think about. How much executive action, really pushing the boundaries of traditional norms, pushing against established legal frameworks, how much can a system like ours actually withstand before the checks and balances themselves, the courts, Congress, the bureaucracy, are fundamentally redefined? What does that look like?
That's definitely a lot to mull over, isn't it? And that's exactly what we love to do here on the Deep Dive. Take all the complex sources you send us and really try to unearth those critical insights, help connect those dots. We really hope this Deep Dive helps you feel genuinely well-informed about the incredibly complex, interconnected dynamics shaping the U.S. government, even just based on the events of a single, frankly, exhausting day.
Yeah, keep sending us your sources, because that joy of discovery, of figuring things out, understanding the world a little better.
It's a journey we really love taking with you. For the Deep Dive, I'm Alex Johnson.
And I'm Sam Kennedy.
We'll see you next time.